This is Incas on Thrones, the philosophy of the Mayans mingled with tapirs. We are pure and delightsome.
She's alive!
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I am the real Stephen Hawking. The infants use me when they're real, human voices. Just cannot be bothered. Today you are going to hear from Kenneth Lyons. Kenneth does shtick about weird Mormon history stuff. He did his weird Mormon history shtick stuff with Glenn and Bob and John Hamer, and Glenn and Bob and John Hamer listened to that shtick. And now you can, too. But not me. I have lots and lots and lots of black holes to think about. Besides, other than doing occasional voiceover work for the infants, I just cannot be bothered. Take it away, kiddos.
So now, how many podcasts have you been on, Kenneth? Because when we talked at Sunstone, you mentioned you'd done a few.
Yeah,
Have you made the rounds of all the Mormon podcasts except this one?
Like Pokemon, I'm trying to catch them all. So yeah. I was on Mormon Stories, but they didn't like the audio. So we're supposed to redo that one someday. And that's okay. John DeLynn someday.
Yeah.
I've done Year of Polygamy. I've been on two.
Mm-hmm.
I've done Mormon Expositor like five or six times. And then I did a bunch of stand-up routines. This nutty Mormon history comes from the post.
Oh, it's nutty. It's not weird. I've been calling it weird Mormon history. It's nutty.
Nutty. Because weird is too aggressive.
Fine with me. I'll go ahead and stick with weird.
I was going for in between. And so nutty, the definition of nutty is anything in which most of it made it into a manual or into a talk, but they put the little ellipses and cut out something. So the origin of Nutty Mormon History was I was an Elder's Quorum instructor. I was an Elder's Quorum instructor for 7 years, and I was in the Brigham Young Manual, which tells you how long ago it was. And I was reading along, and it said
how long have you been out, Kenna?
I have been – this was actually – I was still in at that point. I've been out since – I resigned in 2012. I've been non-attending since 2011.
Okay. And I've been non-attending since probably 2011 too. So like I don't get the reference for the Brigham Young Manual and how long of a time that's been.
That was 2007, 8?
Yeah. So. Yeah. I don't even know how I would know that.
but it read something along the lines of, and I don't have the exact quote, but celestial marriage ... is essential for all of us. And I just looked up the quote, right? And in the quote, it referenced the Deseret News in 1977. And I'm like, Brigham Young was not saying anything in 1977. So I looked up that reference, and it said a Sunday school manual from 1976. I'm like, Brigham Young did not say anything in 1976 either. So I looked up that one, and after like five or six, like going around and around the circle of correlation, yeah, I finally Googled it.
You found the original quote?
Yeah, the whole quote is, celestial marriage, which is polygamy, is required for every man to enter into the celestial kingdom. And that is nutty Mormon history.
So, it sounds like nutty actually means normal. So this is really just normal Mormon history.
That one piece was just too nutty, right? Celestial marriage being required, not too nutty. We can do that. It's not anti-Mormon because it's in the manual.
Yeah.
A little snippet.
But we've got to redefine what celestial means by taking out the polygamy part of it.
That's right. But we're not going to go find another quote. We're going to actually quote Brigham.
Right.
And just leave it in there. Just make sure that you cut out the – so that's nutty Mormon history. We're going to go
– So when you started doing this – did you call it nutty Mormon history as, you know, a softer adjective, nutty, softer than weird, because you were kind of aiming for Mormon as well as ex-Mormon audiences? Or did you always have like an ex-Mormon audience in mind?
No, I was just trying to reconcile, I think, in my own heart and mind why this had happened. And I could picture someone in the correlation department sitting there going, well, that's a little nutty. We need to take that out. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, snip, snip, and everything's fine. So it was more about my own, where my heart was.
Yeah.
So are we considered started? Should I just start talking? Have I already?
What have you been doing up to this point?
And I'll be fair.
Well, we can make introductions. This is Bob Caswell.
Hey there.
Karaoke singer extraordinaire.
That's right. My true passion, karaoke. Is this thing working? Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can.
Okay.
That was actually a lot of fun.
Yeah, I thought.
But next time we have to take turns.
Did I monopolize the...
A little bit. Backstreet Boys. Come on. Yeah.
Well, that's just being insistent.
Yeah, okay. All right. So, Kenneth, for Bob's sake, should we start over?
Yeah, let's go ahead and just kick it off with an official and yeah, we'll go from there. That works. Okay.
All right. We're officially started. So Bob, this is Kenneth, and Kenneth has done a thing called Nutty Mormon History. How did that evolve, Kenneth? Where did that come from?
So I was an Elders Quorum instructor for a very long time, and there came a day where I was studying for the lesson in the Brigham Young Manual. That would put it back in, 2007, 2008? Uh-huh. And there was this line that said, celestial marriage, ... is essential for man to reach the celestial kingdom. And being a thorough teacher and having grown up raised by someone who admired Hugh Nibley very much, you have to check your sources of sources. That's what he said to Fawn Brody. That's what I need to do. So I checked the source, and it said this quote came from a Deseret News article in 1977. And as much as I love to believe there's a zombie Brigham Young in 1977 talking about celestial marriage, probably not the case. So I looked up the source on that one, and it said Sunday School Manual 1976. And I thought, no, Brigham wasn't around then either. So I'll look up the next one and the next one. About five sources later, I finally said, screw it. I'm going to go to the internet, typed in the quote and the dates from the Deseret News article and so forth, and out popped the full quote, which was, celestial marriage, which is polygamy, is required for every man to enter into the celestial kingdom. And I thought, someone somewhere said, that bit's just too nutty.
Yeah.
That's too nutty for our average member. We're just going to cut that out and no one will notice. And hence, Nutty Mormon History was born, finding out all those pieces they thought were just a little too nutty to share with everyone else.
So how many of these little nuggets, nutty nuggets, do you have? Because you've turned this into like a stand-up routine, is that right?
That's right. I've done two of them. I've got a third one prepared.
Two routines or just two ellipses?
two routines. Yeah. Okay. Two hour-long presentations of,
wow.
Oh my gosh, what do they mean? So here we go. Some of it's going to go a little beyond ellipses, but places where they quote, Wilford Woodruff doing something or Joseph Smith saying something, all throughout whatever, and then you look up the rest of it and say, huh, that's a lot. I mean, one of the very basic ones that I think probably several, I think you've covered this before on another podcast, is that there were four witnesses, right? There weren't three. There were the three men, and then there was David Whitmer's wife, and she also said that Angel Moroni showed up and showed her the plates.
Really? I didn't know that. I've never heard that before. No, that's cool.
She describes him as arriving wearing brown clothing and opening a knapsack, and that he was like this haggard old man.
He came to her house or something. Is that right? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, the other guys were all down on the mountain. This guy shows up and opens up the knapsack, and she sees the plates. That one was too nutty. We just got a. There were three witnesses.
Well, there's lots of unofficial witnesses.
Really, there's more. There's more than the fourth.
Yeah.
Yep. Wow.
Yeah.
And are they all equally as nutty as opening up a knapsack and wearing the plates?
Takes the
cake. Yeah, no, she's got a really good one. Go on.
So I want to do a comparison, and that is between things that feel right and things that follow the doctrine but feel wrong. I'm just going to do a quick juxtaposition. That is Saturday's Warrior, right? Saturday's Warrior. Everyone remembers Saturday's Warrior. The Brethren actually talked about this as being false doctrine, right? There's the whole, will I wait for you? And this idea that you were meant from before this world. Haven't I seen that voice somewhere before? Heard that voice somewhere before? And they actually, I've got a list of talks where they say, do not teach that we have one soul partner. They actually taught against what was contained in Saturday's Warrior.
Well, that kind of goes against polygamy, doesn't it?
It does go against polygamy among all sorts.
Soulmates.
I mean, the little girl dies, right? Or the girl in the wheelchair, and she immediately hugs the younger sister who hasn't been born yet, which means spirit paradise is the same place as the celestial kingdom, right? Yeah, no, that's not doctrine. That's
the pre-existence.
Yeah. Whereas I just saw the Book of Mormon musical for the first time.
Oh, congratulations.
And in that one, you have some accurate, like, the things that we believe in, from coffee being evil to saying flipping heck or OM gosh, the way that missionaries interact. But it's put into this context of, like, Uganda and all the weirdnesses of Africa and how this really white Utah clean sort of doctrine feels funny when you put it into another location. And of course there's all the humor with, you know, carnal intercourse with frogs and things that's not doctrine, but this idea that some things feel awful, but are true. And some things feel great, but the brethren have actually spoken against it. We're going to have a few of those that feel awful, and that I think this is the source of Nutty Mormon history, is that people wanted it to feel right more than they wanted it to be actually true. So here we go. You ready?
I think so.
Absolutely.
All right. 1835, the copy of the Book of Commandments says that Oliver Cowdery had the power of the rod. And this was later changed to the Rod of Aaron. Father Smith consecrated dowsing rods in the Kirtland Temple before a treasure hunt in 1836. Now, this particular story...
Wait. Before a treasure hunt in 1836?
That is correct.
Was this the Salem, where they were going to go to Salem to find treasure there, or is this a different treasure hunt?
This is a different treasure hunt. So this is Father Smith, not Joseph Smith. Joseph is not involved. There's a kid by the name of James C. Brewster, and he is completely left out of our lesson manuals for some reason. You might hear his story and think it's a little familiar. When he was 14 years old, he decided he needed to help the Mormon Church get out of debt. So not the Mormon Church, I'm sorry, the Church of Christ, because that's right. Time. And so he went and got a seer stone, and he started to look for buried treasure. And after he looked for buried treasure, people decided that he was a prophet and that he should write a book. So he compiles a book, and people...
I love that. I've never heard this. This is awesome.
Like a prophet. And in fact, he was there when Father Smith consecrated these dowsing rods. And you might say, why did this boy think that he was able to treasure hunt and make dowsing rods and things like that? Well, it turns out that Father Smith gave him a patriarchal blessing in which he was told he possessed the gift of finding treasure using a rod.
Whoa.
Is Charles Brewster is his name?
No, James
C. Brewster. James.
Oh, James. Well, the C stands for Charles.
Colin.
Well, at some James point... James Colin Brewster.
Colin used to mean Charles back in the day.
So James C. Brewster begins to get a following, and so what do the leaders do? They're out in Missouri while this Kirtland nonsense is going on, but start to write about why a kid would never be allowed to start a church. Mm. And it reads like anything that they ever said that the preacher said to Joseph Smith, right?
Wow. Yeah.
And he ends up getting a gap. Gathering a group of people together, he declares a new Zion down in Texas, and they leave the church and head on down to try to form a new cooperative group. Somehow, this kid trying to follow the prophet and obeying his patriarchal blessing didn't make it in the manual.
No, it's not a franchise manual.
I love that story. How did they consecrate the dowsing rods? Was it with the oil and everything, or do we know what that process was?
Not specified. I don't know. However, we're going to get to it in just a second of what I think happened.
All right.
Because this is on the farm's response to the gift of Aaron as part of the proof that Oliver Cowdery having a dowsing rod is true and good. They use this whole Father Smith story to kind of back it up. And yet it leads to this whole James C. Brewster craziness that was always left out. There's this other story that never really gets told, and I heard this as a kid, and I always wanted to see one of these. This is one of my favorite things ever. When Joseph Smith died, and Hiram Smith died. The owner of the Nauvoo Hotel, not Nauvoo, the Carthage Hotel, helped to construct this, what do I want to say, a box to take the bodies back in, and they later kind of made it into a wagon. They brought them back to Nauvoo, and of course the two of them bled all over it. So after that, they take the bodies out and they put them into regular caskets. They take this wooden crate and they lathe it and they fashion it into canes. And they take hair from the death masks of Joseph and Hiram and they braid it together. They put it in the top of these canes with a little window so that you can see the braided hair. And these became known as the Canes of the Martyrdom. And they made 12 of them. And they gave them to Emma Smith for her to give to whoever she thought should get them. Now, if you have 12 canes, who do you think those should go to?
The 12 apostles?
The 12 Abels.
Which, of course, is not who they end up with. Although Brigham does get one, and Wilford Woodruff gets one. But Joseph Smith's bodyguard gets one, for example. Mm. If you go to the Utah Daughters of Pioneers, you can, or on my blog, exploringmormonism.com, I've got some photos. You can actually see some of these coffin canes and their magical abilities. They would cure people who were sick. You could put them under your head. And in fact, the Abraham Cannon family received one cane. However, two branches of the family have canes, and both of them claim that their cane is the authentic one that cures magical abilities. So at some point there was like, I don't know, a Berenstain Mandela effect, and the cane split into two, or someone made a forgery, which again, always fascinating.
Or it's not, it's not like two of the original 12.
What do you mean? No, the one family, the Abraham Cannon family received one. And yet two branches of the family claim ownership of it.
Huh.
They claim that they're one, that they each have one, and they claim that that's the authentic one.
But so at some point someone made a fake one and passed it off, is it, or did they obtain one of the other ones somehow?
If they did, they're still claiming that it's the original Abraham Cannon, yeah. not the other. So somewhere there's
But they still exist?
They still exist. If you go to the Utah Daughters of Pioneers Museum, which is right up here on 300 South in Utah, I do a little tour that takes 45 minutes, and you get to see actual coffin canes. Now, now, the coffin cane is a Kirtland cane. Mm. And the Kirtland cane has a little plaque by it that says, this cane was made from the altar in the Kirtland Temple. Now, I don't know if you remember, but the Kirtland Temple wasn't destroyed. It was turned into a barn after the saints left, but it's still standing today. You can still go and see it. So they didn't like chop out a piece of the altar that I know of. I think that they actually put this cane on the altar, and this is one of them that Father Smith dedicated and consecrated, hence it is a Kirtland cane. But maybe someone took a big old hammer and just whacked a piece out of the altar. That kind of appeals to me too. I don't know which it is, but this Kirtland cane exists, and you can go and take a look at it.
But are its stats? Plus 5 what? Plus 10 dexterity.
Yes.
They sound like Diablo.
And they have minor healing. And one of the interesting things is there is an account of Heber C. Kimball. He also got one of these canes where he would ask it questions and it would either bob or shake, and he would use it like a Ouija cane because it was one of the canes of the martyrdom and possessed these magical abilities. And it's his daughter and daughter-in-law.
What would it do for Outlook unclear?
Circles, I guess, or maybe vigorous shaking. Yeah. I don't know.
Are all of these stories traceable back to the daughters of people, and that's why we just forgot about them? Or
yes, exactly. This is the stuff that Correlation decided that was not part of being a true Mormon. Once upon a time, Harold B. Lee's Correlation Committee put 72 note cards up on the wall and said, this is what it means to be a Mormon, and anything else is too nutty. You're going to trim it away. And that is why sacrament meeting is boring, because this is really interesting sacrament meeting stuff. I'm sure you're all familiar with Brigham Young saying, this is the place to build the temple. You all remember that?
Yeah.
This is the place to build the temple, or was it this is the place we're going to settle?
This is the place to build the temple to our God. Driver, drive on. And the driver in that case, by the way, was one of his slaves. They cut that part out too. A little too nutty for the average Mormon. Mm. But the when he says this is the place, he's actually using his coffin cane, or he's using his cane to point at the area and select it. Now, which cane is it? And I've done a lot of research to try to figure out which cane this was. There are two sources. One of them is Phineas Young. Phineas Young is Brigham Young's cousin. He married Oliver Cowdery's sister. You got that?
Okay.
Phineas Young went back across the plains to get Oliver Cowdery's rod, and he gives it to Brigham. Not across the plains, from winter quarters. He goes back and he gets it, and he gives it to Brigham.
And this is a dowsing rod, or this is one of those Joseph Hiram braided hair rods?
This is, I believe,
Staff of Mithrandil.
Dowsing rod from the Book of Commandments where we started.
Okay.
He goes back and gets that rod and he gives it to Brigham. He claims it, and there's a second source saying that Brigham Young's cane was Oliver Cowdery's dowsing rod. So dowsing rods, we talk a little bit about it with magic in the worldview. You never talk about it in church, but it was really key back then. And the Farms article will defend that Oliver Cowdery's rod was legitimate because they know deep down it goes all the way to Brigham Young, but they're not going to tell you that because it's a little too nutty.
When you say legitimate, what does that mean? Like what powers did Oliver Cowdery claim that he could do? And was it like a hearkening back to the Moses story with the rod of Moses, the rod of Aaron, that sort of thing?
So this Book of Commandments chapter is where Oliver Cowdery tries to translate the plates, but he fails. It says after that, you have a gift, which is the gift of the rod. He had used it to go treasure hunting before. He started translating the Book of Mormon, so it's probably before rather than part of the Mormonism's tale at that point.
Is there any way we can rule out that it wasn't just a euphemism for sex?
I think that there's a physical rod that was given to Brigham Young that I think is in a case at Utah Daughter of Pioneer. Probably. I think we can
just checking, you know.
Right, but that still could have been used for sex, right?
There's a knob on the end. We'll leave it there. Yeah. You can let your imagination run wild.
But John, let me. Oh, you've got your fidget spinner. I've got mine right here.
This
is the one that Richard Holdman gave us, right?
Yeah, exactly.
God, these things are cool. like with Oliver Cowdery and the rod, are there stories that exist in people's journals and things like that? Because I got to imagine if he had this and it was important enough to get to Brigham Young, it must have been in you. Like he must have been using it to do stuff, or to at least claim to be doing stuff. Are there any stories about that?
I don't have, not for Oliver's rod, because he kind of leaves the church. Remember after that whole Fanny Alger transaction?
Yeah, but that was 38, right? That was 1838 that he was excommunicated.
That's right. But I don't have anything beyond, I don't know. I would love to be out at one of their regular meetings and see, like, Oliver bring the rod out for some good old-fashioned whatever he would use it for. I don't know.
I think the idea, you know, like when you're saying the gift of the rod and using that for revelation, it's this idea that you can use it for yes and no questions. And so, therefore, if you're going to use it for translation, essentially Oliver would have to be doing this thing where he's doing the oral composition, and then you would ask whether it's correct or not.
Because that would make sense.
So he would be like thinking, and it didn't come to pass, and the rod would go, no. And it did come to pass. Yes. Okay. And then he knows which one to write down. Like that's a laborious composition process.
And you wonder why it said that it didn't work.
Right. Yeah. Duh.
You know, and so that's why you failed to translate. Yeah. Oliver. So
Oliver, you're taking too long.
So I have a question here. I just want to pause for a second. So in my experience, the two most common responses from an active Mormon to this kind of stuff is either A, you know, it's not in church approved material and therefore it's questionable, or, you know, there's got to be that 10% that isn't accurate, which explains why it all makes sense and isn't nutty. Or B, my personal favorite is like, hey, come on, we're all human. This just proves that Mormons are human, and you know, every religion or every institution or every piece of history about a people is going to be full of colorful stories, and what's wrong with that? And I'm just wondering, this is a question generally, is one or both of those acceptable answers, or you think that's what do you think about that?
So I'm in the camp A. That's where I found all of this, is I believe that if I just researched it more, it would all make sense. Everything that I have listed comes from an LDS source, hence the nutty Mormon history. It's not anti-Mormon. Anti-Mormon would be outside of church sources. Every one of these I found by going to a church website and reading and then looking up the sources from there. So I go ahead and go with crowd B if you're a believing Mormon and listen to Infants on Thrones. A does not work for you.
Okay, so you're A. You were playing the mental gymnastics game of like feeling like, oh, there's got to be more to this story, and it'll all make sense. And then it just, the rabbit hole kept getting deeper. It's not like you came out on another side, and it did make sense. Unless you want to come out now as an active believing Mormon, and this is just all a, you know.
Ta-da! Reveal. I've been on a mod on the ex-Mormon subreddit for 10 years. And it was all just a hoax, guys. I really was believing the whole time. No. I'm having a little bit of fun with all of it. This was the stuff that was on my shelf in very serious ways that I knew about for years. I knew that I'd given kind of questionable answers. And then one day, my poor, darling oldest daughter came to me, and she asked a question about marriage that led me to go and look up Helen Mar Kimball. Because I needed to give her the true answers. I couldn't just give the answers I'd given as a missionary. And I kept believing more research would solve it. And all of this comes from that.
So it comes from a good place, but it ended up kind of in a bad one, at least for the church.
For the church, yes. Did anyone else want to answer on the A, B?
Glenn, did you have a preference when you were active and believing? Which route did you go?
Things like this didn't buy. It was like the Moon Men story that I heard. But I guess with that one, I thought that Joseph Smith probably had a sense of humor and was telling jokes. And some people thought, you know, because Truman Madsen, you know, I listened to those Joseph Smith tapes of Truman Madsen all the time as a missionary. And he would talk about Joseph Smith having a sense of humor and, really trying to stick it to the stodgy people that thought that a prophet should be a certain way. And so he would kind of play around and mess around with them. And so I had this space where I thought, oh, well, maybe they took things seriously that he didn't intend to be serious, but yeah, I don't know. I probably would have gone more towards the people are human and we have foibles kind of thing. And it doesn't really, it's not pertinent to our salvation.
You win.
Kind of thing. And don't let things like this trip you up. And that would have been my approach.
Celestial marriage, which is polygamy, is essential for everyone.
Yeah. And I've told this story before when I've talked about my ex-wife. We were married for 17 years. And, you know, in that time she moved a little bit from where she started to where she ended up as far as belief. But I went from like one extreme to another almost, you know, where I really believed. I remember having this conversation with her early on about polygamy, and she thought, oh, there's no way that this is real. Joseph Smith just made that up. And like, what? Are you kidding me? How could you believe something like that? Of course, Joseph Smith wouldn't just make something up. God wouldn't let him. You know, God wouldn't allow him to continue to be a prophet if he was lying and making stuff up. So it must be true. And it's just been discontinued. And she's like, well, I'm never going to do it. Like, well, you may not be required to, but you can't say that Joseph Smith wasn't a prophet, you know?
Right.
Until you can.
I have to say, I was more in the A camp in the sense that I always thought that the Mormon leadership had things figured out in a super special way that we just couldn't see all of. And the more that you would do the digging, but even then, if you found the wrong things when you're digging, then you're just digging it wrong, or you're, you know, you're just still missing some context. Or, and this does may seem like a weird comparison, but when Randy and I did that church finances episode, we got a lot of flack for it, because at the time, part of my perspective was, can you believe all this crazy shit the Mormons are doing with playing games with their finances, just like the rest of the finance world? And we got a lot of people commenting, and I'm sort of paraphrasing and oversimplifying, basically saying, well, of course they are. Like, everybody does that. They're not doing anything questionable necessarily, if that's how financially the structure of nonprofit organizations should work, such that they perpetuate to exist forever. And then I was thinking, like, what are you talking about? There's got to be some secret sauce. There's got to be a plan A, which is like, because they have the direct line to God, they can't just be mimicking what the worldly people do and just making the best of like all the financial loopholes that everybody else does. That can't be the answer. And really, it just turns out that that's more likely the answer. They're humans and not that far off from anyone else. But I kept wanting, in my type of being a believing Mormon, to think that like they had something more. They had some secret sauce that made it so that there's a bigger plan. Do you guys ever have that, or is that just a me thing?
I think my version of that was thinking that the ways of God and the ways of heaven are so much more advanced than we're able to really follow at this time. So I would look at things like the law of consecration, United Order, that, you know, all these times where God's trying to institute, and we're not ready for it. And I lumped polygamy into that, you know, as well, and thought, you know, jealousy is really what keeps people from having polyamorous relationships. And jealousy is such a petty human condition that we will transcend in the afterlife, you know. So I think that was my version of that.
Polyamory is totally permitted by the Mormon Church. It's the higher law.
Well, and again, this was something that my ex-wife would tease me about. She's like, oh, so you think that in heaven you're going to be getting with your grandma, huh? And you're comfortable with that? And I'm like, well, it sounds really creepy when you say it that way, but that's because I'm human and I'm petty. But, you know, like, maybe it is okay in heaven and we'll be all right. Just embrace it.
You know? I had a coworker who came up with the answer that we all marry everybody.
Yeah, well, I thought that, yeah.
Oh, gosh. Well, yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say another version of that for me was, you know, the millennial state of how, like, there's going to be two capitals and, like, Missouri's the political one and Jerusalem's the religious one. And I remember as a believer thinking, like, that's brilliant. If only, like, every nation had, like, the religious capital and the political capital.
Yeah.
That's like so like godly, but we as a people on this earth aren't ready for it. And so I like what you're saying, Glenn, like there's that whole, you know, well, we have to operate in the time and place that the rest of the world will allow us to, because
yeah,
because otherwise the world is
those ready. Are the cards we've been dealt, and yeah, God knows. I remember when I first started becoming more accepting of homosexuality, my rationale for it was that in the pre-existence, we all loved each other with this powerful
platonic thing or
love,
or even just,
I wasn't thinking of it as a sexual attraction thing. I was just thinking of it as a love. And that when like people who are homosexual and they're attracted to other people, it's just the veil is super thin for them, and they're just feeling that love, you know. So, like, I've never heard anybody else articulate it like that. There's probably other people that's thought pretty good, that
because that gives them like this false sense of superiority. That's like a token, like, see, you're close to the veil. Never mind that you don't get to do anything that I get to do. But
yeah, I don't know. Like, I felt it made me feel good in a way that, like, I'm not saying that it's icky and gross, right. You know,
but totally different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Arsenic and old men. So you may have heard, you know, Joseph and Hiram were shot in Carthage, of course. That one comes up all the time. And that Brigham Young was the successor of the church. But there's a little known footnote in there that, you know, Hiram, sometimes you'll get someone who really knows the story that will say Hiram was going to take over after Joseph, but he was also killed. But Samuel Smith was actually declared to be the successor as well, without much rebuttal. But a curious thing happens to Samuel Smith. He is very, very sick. And his nursemaid by the bed is Hosea Stout. He was the chief of police in Nauvoo. And when he dies, when Samuel Smith dies, he cries out that he was poisoned. And there's another fellow that was being nursed by Hosea Stout, and he refused to take the medicine and says that that's why he lived. We don't really know whether he was poisoned or not. But there's an interesting footnote that Hosea Stout was helping to take care of these two men, and the brother of the prophet cries out on his deathbed that he has been poisoned and dies. Well, it turns out there was also a string of arsenic poisoning in Nauvoo related to individuals who revealed polygamy. This was a method that was used, and there are documents about the various arsenic poisonings. And Brigham Young himself, when he dies, there's a couple of articles about it being symptomatic of arsenic poisoning. It has a very kind of distinct way of dying. But this all just kind of led me as I was going through, and it's just kind of a curious point that arsenic poisoning was a common thing with Mormonism, I guess. The people around me, if it was mobs coming in and doing it, I'm okay with that. But the point is that it was tied to ways of offing people back in the 1800s.
Did they do any type of autopsy on Samuel Smith? Were they able to rule a cause of death as being arsenic? Or are you just kind of making that connection?
So the description goes like an arsenic poisoning, but no, they don't do any sort of autopsy. And I don't know how much I'd trust an 1800s autopsy either. But there are some distinctive description, and I would read it, but I don't have it right now in front of me. But I do have a post about it. But that leads us to Wilford Woodruff, who doesn't die of arsenic poisoning. But he does die in some curious circumstances that are left out. Sometimes you will hear that Wilford Woodruff died in San Francisco. You'll hear that he died and Lorenzo Snow became prophet at like a record-breaking pace. You'll hear that that Lorenzo Snow was like, it was suddenly revealed that Jesus appeared to him in the temple, in the Salt Lake Temple. There's a granddaughter story about it. But they leave out this really curious bit that changes the story entirely. And that is that Wilford Woodruff died in San Francisco after speaking at the Bohemian Club. Do you know what the Bohemian Club is? It's Alex Jones crazy. That's what it is. Alex Jones, if you know Alex Jones from the raving lunatic guy, anyone who loves him, I'm sorry, but on cable news or whatever.
InfoWars, right?
InfoWars, right. So he did this expose that there's this club where they have a giant carved owl off of Athena. And, you know, the various presidents have been there. They dress up in women's clothing and do low jinks, and they have a play in hijinks, and they dress up a doll to look like their cares, and they burn it in effigy. It's a really weird thing. And it turns out that this is contemporary with Wilford Woodruff. About 3 years before Wilford Woodruff went and spoke at it, they started going to this grove. And it was this society that took the really artsy, creative types and put it together with the wealthy politicians. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And they would all party together and have this really fun time. And Richard Nixon is actually quoted, you can find the quote on YouTube, as saying it's the faggotiest thing he has ever been to. He wasn't a big fan of the Bohemian Grove. But we find that this is the spot where Wilford Woodruff spoke on Monday, and he was dead on Thursday. Now, why did they send Wilford Woodruff out to San Francisco? Well, he was having some trouble with his digestion, and they decided the fresh air of San Francisco would do him good. I am sure that is the last time that statement was ever uttered, the fresh air of San Francisco would do good. But he's sent out, and he rides out. He gives the speech. I thought, well, how often was it for 80-year-old men to speak? They give him this prestigious octogenarian award. I'm like, that sounds pretty cool. Turns out he is the only octogenarian award ever given and the only person invited out to speak because he was an octogenarian. So just weird all the way around.
So all right. you think he was invited out to San Francisco specifically to be poisoned?
Well, no. So I looked into it because I thought, this is a weird death. Maybe he was poisoned. And I thought, who would poison the president of the church? And, you know, the church is in really bad debt at this point. They have gotten into debt with bankers in a really bad way, in a really hardcore way. And I thought, maybe the bankers are meeting at this Bohemian Grove because it's the rich and the powerful. And maybe he does give a speech all about how the Utah is independent and they don't need the rest of the world. So maybe they got some revenge. But he dies out of really natural causes, and the bankers the church was in debt to were all Eastern bankers, and none of them were in this Bohemian Grove in the West. So I started looking into it, thinking maybe there's some foul play that was going on here. But it turns out it doesn't look like it. Now, he does go out with the man who helped Utah become a state. And in a really weird coincidence, that man ends up with this really weird connection of this woman who comes after him and beats him to death in an alley because he sold her shares in a gold mine in Idaho that didn't exist. So there's plenty of wacky and nutty. But as far as foul play for Wilford Woodruff, I don't think so. However, this is when Lorenzo Snow takes over, and he really rapidly comes up with tithing as a way to pay off bankers. So I thought it was a pretty good lead to go look up. But old men dying in an awkward circumstance.
There you go. What was the reason for the invite? Like, why did somebody in San Francisco say, hey, let's get the Mormons to come talk at this faggy club? Their words, not mine, right?
If you find the answer, send it to me. Okay. I cannot find why he got this invitation. Other than that the brethren agree that they should send him out because it would be good for his health, which turned out to not be very good for his health.
I mean, that makes sense for the San Francisco part, but the actual reason for a prophet to speak at a club that's somewhat antithetical, I mean, I guess I'm talking by 20th century or 21st century standards of Mormonism, and maybe back then they were more amenable to those sorts of things, but it just seems very odd.
I will state that there is one footnote in Michael Quinn's Hierarchy of Power that reads as thus: all male dancing in the tabernacle ended in 1928. I have no idea what that means either, but I would love to connect the two somehow. Anyway,
didn't Brigham Young like institute dancing? That was like one of the biggest things that he did.
I don't know.
In the temple.
I'm interested. You've got me. Do you have anything more on it?
So Brigham Young hijacked the church in Nauvoo and worked on finishing the Nauvoo temple, which had only been up one story tall when Joseph Smith died. And so they had a big dance on the second floor, and they had so many people up there. The thing had never been finished, and so they had so many people up there, cracked the, you know, the... Anyway, it was unsafe, and they had to actually vacate the space, you know.
And I seem to remember a story that when they first got to Salt Lake and they built the tabernacle, maybe they did dances and they did a lot then. So I don't know. I just wonder if that tradition was started and then ended. What was it, 1928, you said, was when the
1928 for all-male dancing. Yeah. I don't know about any other all-male dancing. It's just one footnote, and I don't know. So finish the quote. There is no Bible. So if you go on to Fair Mormon and you look up, question, did Joseph Smith know what the italicized areas of the Bible are? You can still look at this today. They haven't edited it. There, it reads as thus: just as there is no evidence that Joseph owned the Bible, that's their answer to, could he have known the italicized portion of the King James Bible? And if you look at the footnote they use, this is from Emma to support the claim. It's from an interview where she says that Joseph Smith had nothing to do with polygamy or spiritual lives, so we know that it's totally credible. In addition, she calls the Brighamite branch of the church a newfangled notion, and the whole thing is anti-Brigham Young. It's this terrible just rant on how that the church has fallen. But, you know, they'll take her as credible when it comes to that Joseph didn't own a Bible because they needed that snippet. Not nutty at all. The other thing to know is that if you go to the Utah Daughter of Pioneers Museum and you make a beeline straight for the back past Brigham Young's magic amulet plus two of protection.
What?
Yeah, they have it. Magic
amulet?
Amulet.
Was the word magic really used?
He would wear it whenever he was going into places of danger. That's what the little card reads. I'm not making any of that up. D&D is true, guys. It's true. Magic rods and amulets. Okay, so if you make a beeline straight past the Brigham Young case that has the amulet, and just go straight back, they have a case of like super valuable collections. And usually there's little old people when they're working. Try not to disturb them. But there is Joseph Smith's uncle's Bible. And it's right there. You can see it. It is his uncle, and it's his Bible. And that Bible happens to not only have the italicized words, but the footnotes in the back happen to match that whole ships of Tarshish and the ships by the sea thing that apologists love to go on about, that no way Joseph could have known. That happens to be in the footnotes of Joseph's uncle's Bible. So they are really...
I'm not familiar with the thing that you're referencing. I don't know, the ships of Tarshish. Is so that Tarshish? That's a funny word.
Nephi quotes Isaiah, and it says, ships of Tarshish and the ships by the sea. I think it's 1 Nephi 16.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that in the Bibles of the day, typically you only have the ships of Tarshish or the ships by the sea, not both. And so the apologist claim is that the Book of Mormon is true because it went back to the real translation where both of these split off from the original document.
No.
But it turns out that it had both translations in the back of his uncle's Bible. So if he just borrowed it from his uncle for a little while, everything's explained, and somehow it ends up in a case in Salt Lake City. Clearly no access.
What's the point of even trying to say that he doesn't have access to the Book of Mormon? The Book of Mormon is conclusively dependent on a King James Bible with italics. So what if you're just trying to argue that Joseph Smith didn't have access to such a Bible, then all you would be arguing is that this 19th century, 100% conclusively proven 19th century text is written by somebody besides Joseph Smith. I mean, he wouldn't be able to access it. I mean, in other words, there's nothing. I mean, there's no point in even arguing this.
But isn't there?
And yet, it is on the Fair website today.
Yeah.
Isn't the argument that, like, maybe God was feeding Joseph the 19th century version, and that's just proof that God was in tune with
the italics?
Yeah. I don't know.
I have a great friend. His name is No Cool Name Tom. You can go read his blog. And he's a Greek scholar. And you can read his numerous times where those italics in the Book of Mormon are translated poorly. So right. God was a bad translator if he was in tune to the 1900 version, I guess. He was also in tune to bad grammar.
Mm-hmm.
That's fair, I guess.
Yeah.
Once upon a time, Hugh Nibley said about the trial in 1826. Now, if you're not familiar, once upon a time ago, Joseph Smith was brought into a court for glass looking. And it's not the Bainbridge trial. It's the other one, not the Judge Purple one, the other one. And we didn't have a lot on it. And Hugh Nibley said, if this court record is authentic, it is the most damning evidence in existence against Joseph Smith. Well, it turns out, that if you go to rickkelsey.org, the 1826 trial testimonies.htm, they have the court record. It was a real court. And they also have the bill for the bailiff that was paid to escort Joseph from the court across the county line. And I have to say that the Fair and Farms reply, right? Again, we're going off of what they have. They say, well, at least he was found not guilty, to which I have to say, you're telling me that the judge ordered, like, bailiff, this man is innocent. Go haul him across the county line now. It just seemed – and why wouldn't you really think it was damning if, in fact, he wasn't found guilty? Anyway, another fun piece of nutty Mormon history is that Michael Quinn found a family dagger in Hiram's possession. And it's described and labeled as dagger, Masonic, 10-inch, stainless steel, wooden handle, Masonic symbols on the blade. And there's several claims that Joseph Smith drew in the ground with a dagger as part of the treasure hunting things. And Fair argues that that it wasn't the dagger, but they brought in a sword for the purpose. And Quinn gets the dates wrong. So, and the sigils aren't as important. And they use sources that are too late. But, you know, they never tackle, why did they own a Masonic dagger? What was the purpose for the Hiram Smith family to own a particular dagger?
Yeah, I got to say, my Diablo character and Mormonism are really converging through this conversation. I mean, we've got amulets, daggers. Are there rings that you put on and then you get some powers or special things? I'd love to.
I have not looked for a magic ring, but the Hobbit lover in me says I need to go look for magic rings.
They had special rings.
Yes.
So the widow of, so let's see, I can't remember. It's like there's like a couple special gold rings that they had, and Don Carlos's widow, who may also have been one of Joseph Smith's plural wives after Don Carlos died, who later was in Southern California and was an ex-Mormon. I can't remember, but I feel like somebody gave, so like, it's like Joseph the Third or David Hiram Smith was down there. And at some point or other, he gave her the, you know, that ring, the magic ring or whatever, because it was like her inheritance or something like that.
That's
so
awesome.
So there's definitely rings too.
Magic rings too. I know the ring from the King Follett discourse where Joseph says that it's eternity, and they always misquote it as being that marriage is for eternity, but he actually compares it to the priesthood. That was as close as I got. So
somebody should make like an index of like all the Mormon inanimate objects that are quote unquote not magical anymore, but once, like, because literally we've been talking for like 40 minutes and rings, staffs, stones.
Let's not forget the handkerchief, right? The magic handkerchief that was used to heal the cholera when they first got into Nauvoo.
What do we have left? What does modern Mormonism have after all of this is said? And just to compare and contrast, what's inanimate? Just garments, I guess, right?
Is that it? Yeah, yeah. Well, and the oil.
Oil? Oh, yeah. Oil's still around.
You know, the consecrated oil that I borrowed my dad's car the other day, and his keychain had the little thing on it. Yeah. And I went, oh, yeah.
Good times. But that's still like two out of like 20.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. That most of them are falling.
It was nutty. It was nutty. So they had,
nutty.
Yeah. In masonry, just so you know, the dagger is used with the cable toe. The symbolism is that if you rush quickly into the temple, you will be stabbed. And if you go too slow, you will be hung. The dagger is placed against the bare breast of the first of your initiation into the first degree. Got that?
Sure.
So this is why Hiram had his dagger, so he could put the dagger up against his breast. And it turns out that there is an old Nauvoo newspaper that says you need to bring your own dagger to the temple in the times and seasons.
BYOD. Got it.
Yeah, yeah. And rumor is that you would cut the garments while the people were wearing it back in the day using their own dagger. So you would cut the marks and they would go home and stitch it up later. So there you go. Why you need a dagger in the Hiram household. Sally Chase. Everyone know Sally Chase?
Mm-mm.
Uh-huh. Sally Chase is in the Ensign described as a wicked seer who attempted to take the plates from Joseph. It turns out that Joseph obtains his first seer stone from Sally Chase, and he gets his second one by looking in the first one, and that comes from the refiner's fire, making a Mormon cosmology. Willard Chase, her father, was part of the treasure hunting group that Joseph and his father were in before, and Joseph went to Willard Chase to get the box he kept the plates in, and he promised him a portion of the revenue from the plates as payment, according to the court testimony of Willard Chase, who we know is wicked and evil because he isn't Joseph's on Joseph's side.
Well, and we also know Joseph would never, ever seek money from gold plates. That was never the point, according to Mormon history.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Which is a shame, because if you really think about it, if Moroni had included one blank gold leaf,
would have really helped things out, yeah.
He could have funded the entire publication from that, as well as probably mortgaged the farm, because gold was worth a lot.
Yeah.
So Samuel Lawrence is only mentioned in trying to steal the plates. But it turns out that Joseph took him to the Hill Cumorah in 1825, and he was the first person in history to mention, he says to Joseph, look, is there not something else there? And Joseph replies, I don't see it. And he says, look again. And Joseph says, I see the interpreters. Meant to translate the plates. The Urim and Thummim was first identified by Samuel Lawrence.
Ding, ding, another object. Yes.
This Samuel Lawrence guy, well, it turns out that he taught Sally Chase how to be a seer as well. And that's why Joseph's mother and father went to him and paid him money for something called a layman. A layman is kind of a magical parchment, if you want to think of it like a placemat. And you can Google this and find Joseph Smith, magical layman Samuel Lawrence, it'll come right up. And this magical layman was to tell him when to interact with spirits. And according to Michael Quinn, it points to the exact date and time he was supposed to meet the angel Moroni. So you have magical parchments. You can add spell scrolls right to your thing. And maybe some sort of summoning to the other plane. I mean, We're doing pretty good for a good solid D&D here. I bet you didn't know that Dungeons and Dragons was.
Now that reminded me of something that I learned for the first time, I think 2 years ago when I was reading through Bennett's Mormon history, whatever that whatever.
It's called. the expose on the saints or something like that. But yeah, John C. Bennett got
John
it.
John C. Bennett, yeah. And there was an exchange that this between Isaac Hale, so Emma's father, and somebody else, and he said that around this time when the golden plates before they had been translated, that Emma was pregnant. She ended up miscarrying. But that Joseph told them all that he wasn't going to be the one that translated the plates. It was going to be his son.
Yeah.
And that it was like from the mouth of babes will come forth this record. So it was like he had this scheme, you know, of course he would be doing it in the background, but then say, look, my son did all of this stuff. How could it have come from a, it doesn't matter if there's italics or not. And it's like, it's an infant.
I'll see scripture. Your 15-year-old and raise you a baby.
Yeah.
Do you suppose that 15 or that baby is on a throne? Is that an infant on a throne now?
I don't know if it counts for miscarriages. That's horrible. I don't know. Yeah, I just don't know.
That is an interesting part of the handbook, by the way.
It's another like ellipsed part of Mormon history. Absolutely. That I had never heard that Joseph had claimed that anybody other than himself would translate the plates. And, you know, if you trust Isaac Hale.
If you, yeah. Which, how can you trust
John C. Bennett
as
or
father?
Yeah.
You know, because he's not Mormon. So here's another good, solid, interesting note. This one comes, there's a whole chapter on it in my book, The ABCs of Science and Mormonism. It's chapter A is for gold because AU is the Latin symbol for gold. And I go into this in a lot of detail. You've heard Sandra Tanner. She's got this 200-pound gold plates that you can go and see at her Lighthouse Ministries. And the gold plates were just way too much for anyone to carry. And so the apologists come up with an answer. They say they were made of tumbaga. Has anyone heard this argument?
No.
Made of this copper gold mesh. Well, it turns out.
That just sounds like tumbaga to me.
Yeah. Right.
Thanks, John.
So it turns out that on eBay, you can buy tumbaga. So I did. I bought two tumbaga plates, and I was very curious because gold cold rolls, right? If you put a heavy weight on your wife's earrings, they smush. And so I got these, and I sat down, and everyone agrees the plates were about 60 pounds, right, including the apologists who are saying it's made of tumbaga. And, well, not everyone, but most of the early accounts say about 60 pounds. So I got these tumbaga plates, and I drew my own characters in by using a screwdriver and a hammer. And they were plus symbols. They weren't terribly complicated characters. And then I put the non-pounded plate underneath the pounded plate, and then I put 40 pounds of weight on top of it, which would be roughly the amount minus the sealed portion, right? And I thought, what will happen in a week, a month, a year, and so forth? Turns out after a month, they totally squish. You could totally see the indent of the pluses on the bottom plate from the top one. And I detail it in the book. You are all free to go and duplicate my research. Go ahead and buy the tumbaga plates.
But so you're saying they really were gold plates?
They had to be real gold.
That's the moral of the story here. Not right. Tumbaga. Really
because the story that's easier to have an explanation for is how to carry gold plates everywhere versus how to
not God gave him like super strong arms that day, you know. I mean, come on.
Or that every day, because didn't he have them for like a long time?
Well, he had to fight people, right? He has running with the plates because there's people coming after him. He dislodges his thumb punching someone.
And like sometimes mothers that are trying to protect their babies can lift up cars, you know, like adrenaline's an amazing thing.
So the plates are like a baby.
And everyone was hefting them.
Yeah.
Everyone was hefting them.
But and kung fu fighting. Everyone was hefting them and kung fu fighting.
In gnarly 1800 beards. So it turns out there's a problem even bigger than the gold plates when it comes to weight, and that's the brass plates.
Uh-oh.
This is chapter B is for brass in the book, and I go into a lot more detail. But just the surface argument, I simply calculated, because it says in the Book of Mormon, they contain the five books of Moses, the writings up to Jeremiah and Zenos and Zenoch, plus Lehi's genealogy. We can't calculate all that, but let's just go with the five books of Moses for now. We know what that is. And it mentions they were written in Messiah. It mentions they were written in Egyptian. So we know the language because in
8-point font, maybe it was, just like squeezed it really tiny little engravings. No,
that's right. Demotic Egyptian was right. What was in use. So how many plates would it take to write Demotic Egyptian, the five books of Moses? It turns out that it would weigh 500 pounds with our modern technology. That's like a vending machine. And Nephi is in full armor. He's like walking out with these things under his arm. Zenos, the servant there, is right next to him. His brothers see him, and he drops these things. Just pong. They would weigh enough if you put in the rest of what would need to be there that you'd have to fashion an anchor for the boat just to ballast wherever the plates were on the boat at the moment. These are not small objects.
I'm starting to think that maybe the story of the golden plates isn't true.
don't let me take you there. We're only nutty.
By the way, the Torah didn't exist in Lehi's time. So even if that's how long it is, it doesn't exist. So you couldn't have engraved it on plates using our modern technology.
Were you there? Were you there?
Yes, I was.
All right. We got to hit polygamy because wonderful nuttiness to it. A large part of the persecution experienced by the Latter-day Saints centered around the practice of plural marriage. Quote from the manuals. In order to avoid arrest, the Bishop of Oxford, Idaho ward left town at night, stowed away in a box marked Pork, Ogden Freight. He remained 24 hours in the box before being set free by a brother Nesbitt. So, yes, there was definitely some opposition due to plural marriage, but the stories that come from it, they're a little more nutty than just, you know, the picturesque mobs. They're hiding in pork boxes and so forth. And my favorite one is Wilford Woodruff. Wilford Woodruff, in February of 1886, came to live with a family, and the mother of the family made him a Mother Hubbard dress and a sunbonnet. Wait, he got away with it for a long time. So if you picture, you know, Wilford Woodruff, he kept the beard through this. He's wearing this old woman's garb, the hide from the law. But one U.S. Marshal got suspicious and waited by the barn for Wilford to return from his morning ritual. When Wilford rounded the corner of the barn, the marshal met him face to face and saw through the disguise somehow that this was not a little old woman.
Hmm.
And after his release from custody is when he issues the manifesto. So he was actually busted in a woman's dress. So yeah, they did get some persecution over it, I guess. And who was the source, right, that Fair Mormon is talking about that made all this anti-polygamy, hate, abuse, persecution? What shall we call it? Well, it turns out in 1862, President Lincoln signed into law the anti-bigamy bill known as the Morrill Law. But it wasn't really enforced because of the Civil War. But it was kind of Abraham Lincoln who kicked off the whole anti-polygamy thing. So I guess he's the source of the Mormon persecution.
And he also didn't appear to, was it Wilford Woodruff in the St. George Temple when all the founding fathers were there saying, do my temple work for us? Abraham Lincoln wasn't there.
He wasn't there, but you also know that they'd already done the work for the founding fathers, right? You've read that Pure Mormonism, liar, liar, pants on fire article. Anyway,
I'm just saying.
Done. So along with this nutty things that you will never, ever read about, if we go again to the Utah Daughters of Pioneers Museum, up on the wall, they have this wonderful picture of George Q. Cannon wearing stripes. And it's everyone around him is a Mormon polygamist who has been taken to prison. And George Q. Cannon was arrested in 1889 for lascivious cohabitation. And the story is a fascinating one because it involves the only Mormon train robbery, which somehow also never makes it into the manuals. So, yes, there was persecution, and it's right to put that in the manual. But again, it's nutty because the federal marshals had George Q. Cannon. They were on the train bringing him back into Salt Lake City, and they were coming around on that California Zephyr line, if you've ever ridden it. And the apostles decide they need to hold up the train. And I don't know that all the apostles go, but there's at least one, and there's some other, I don't know, 70s, whatever. Some of the brethren go, and they hold up the train. But in the meantime, before the holdup, George Q. Cannon excuses himself to the back of the train, and the federal marshal doesn't follow him. And he thinks to himself, you know, I could just leap off this train. I could just step off, and I'd be free. And he does. and he hits the ground with such force that it breaks his nose and gives him a concussion. So the train gets stopped by the Mormons who are trying to free George Buchanan, and that they hold the train up. They go through the train looking through all the compartments to find him, and of course he's not there. And so they back the train up to try to find what happened, and eventually they stumble across the concussed George Buchanan, who was still so dazed he had not gotten off the tracks or wandered away, and he is hauled off to jail after the first, I guess, big Mormon escape from a train and a big train holdup. But for some reason, that kind of persecution, it's just not mentioned.
What year was that approximately?
That was 1889.
Good times.
Good times. His bail was set for $10,000. That's $251,000 in today's money. Not a small thing. Let's see. But there were some serious ones. I don't want to decry it too much with too much levity. Hiram Poole was having a late supper with his brother William. As they were eating, there was a loud knock on the door. They open it, and a gun barrel was rammed through, and the intruder shouted, "Let us in, or we'll break the door down." Finally, the persons forcing admittance condescended to explain that they were deputies with a warrant to search the premises. Total persecution. Those darn federal marshals. But I don't want to encourage no-knock raids. They should have knocked and said that they were from the law to begin with. Edward M. Dalton of Parowan was shot and killed by a deputy marshal. He's riding on horseback down a street in Parowan. Dalton had been indicted in 1885 for unlawful cohabitation. He had evaded trial by going to Arizona. He returned, and the guy sees him and just shoots him dead. Probably not worth shooting dead someone over unlawful cohabitation. There you go. But along with this, Lorenzo Snow did marry a 14 or 15-year-old when he was 56. And if you go to the Lorenzo Snow manual, they have all of his wives except for her. For some reason, they just decided to leave that one out of the manual. All right. Ready for some nutty statistics?
Yeah, let's hear them.
Let's do it. So Todd Compton, in his book, In Sacred Loneliness, says that the Fanny Alger transaction occurred in 1832. On websites today, you can look them up and find out that it occurred somewhere around 1835 by the best approximations by all the faithful Mormons, including Brian Hale's, 1835. In Brian Hale's book, the ceremony occurs in 1836, according to Joseph F. Smith's notes and Eliza R. Snow's recollections when she came to the house. This leads Fair to conclude that she's a legitimate wife, with sex only occurring between 1 and 4 years before the wedding. No problem.
Between 1 and 4 years? So what?
Wait, that's different than...
Timeline.
1832.
Todd Compton. Part of
Fair. Right. When did Emma see them, like, in the barn together?
So somewhere between 1832 and 1835. The latest apologist work puts it at 1835. Todd Compton put it at 1832. The ceremony occurs in 1836. So just do some math. We call it when someone has sex before marriage.
Adultery?
No.
Fornication?
Well, fornication. And if you're previously married to someone else, we call it adultery. Yeah.
And yet Joseph was very clear on that.
Yeah.
Joseph was very clear that he did not commit adultery. He was very clear.
Now, the interesting thing is that Compton's estimate for 1832 is based on Mosiah Hancock's journal, or Levi Hancock's journal I get these two swapped all the time. Mosiah Hancock's journal that Joseph sent a letter to Levi Hancock, his father, proposing a marriage swap, Alger, his niece, for Mosiah Hancock to get a first wife. So there's this interesting dichotomy there, like, that places it at this earlier date of 1832, that Joseph is trying to get this wife swap sort of situation to get the second wife. And they're like, that's okay. It makes sense. Joseph Smith married one woman every 25 days during the Nauvoo period. One woman every 25 days.
Was it the same woman or was it different women?
Different women.
Just to clarify.
With a six-month break after Sarah Pratt. So in those 2 years, with a six-month break, one woman every 25.
I, I just want to say I knew a Sarah Pratt in high school, and I mean, I would probably do the same thing if I had the power. So what, I kind of see where he's
not marry from. Somebody else after 6 months of that.
No comment.
Okay. And then, of course, we all know about Helen Mar Kimball, right? Everyone knows Helen Mar Kimball at this point. When I started doing Nutty Mormon History, it was a shock and a gasp. But we get the essay where it says she was a few months shy of her 15th birthday, and now that one's kind of ruined. But I think that there's an aspect that we don't really focus on that we probably should. One is that 2 months earlier, Joseph proposed to Violet, her mother. And that there is a creepy factor to ask for the mother and then gets the daughter a couple of months later. And the second one is that Heber C. Kimball left Helen Mar to reflect on it for 24 hours. I was skeptical. 1 minute believed, then doubted. I the thought of the love and tenderness that he felt for his only daughter. I knew he wouldn't cast me off. And this was the only convincing proof that I had of this polygamy relationship being right. And, you know, if we were to take any cartoon character and give the female in the cartoon 24 hours to decide to marry, that is a Snidely Whiplash level of evil. Mm-hmm. That is tied to the tracks making decisions in the 1800s. It's nutty. That gets cut out. They never say that, not even in the new polygamy essay that's supposed to explain things. Yeah, she was given 24 hours to decide.
Wow. Well, but again, we either don't know the full story or everybody's doing it. I mean,
that is a quote from her own journal. So, I mean, you can call her a liar, but yeah. All right. Just to wrap up, are you all familiar with the facsimile number 2, the circle one, right? With the cows.
Yep.
Okay.
And you are familiar, I am sure, but we have to mention it because someone thought this was too nutty. Of the little picture down in the corner of the guy on the throne and the little bird thing giving hands to him. And then he has this really straight jutting piece coming
something.
Off of
him. Yeah. Rod. And
a rod, shall we say. And that this is, in fact, the god Min. And that this is an erect phallus. There are two pieces of nutty Mormon history that come off of this. And that is that in the 1970s, they actually edited the penis out. Someone knew that this was Min. And they knew what that was. And so if you find one of the old 1970s Doctrine and Covenants, you can flip to the facsimile and the penis will be gone. And yet they kept all the rest of it. They knew exactly what was being implied here and how this and yet. But it was too nutty. So we're
like,
edit that bit out.
Just the tip or like to lob the whole thing off or just make it not erect? Like I just want to understand.
It's upside down, right?
Yeah, it's upside down.
Because I'm looking at it right now.
He looks like a Barbie figure. There's nothing there. There's no stub. There's no piece.
TK smoothie style. Okay.
TK smoothie style. The other piece
of nuttiness. It's very unsullied.
That's right.
That's right.
The other piece of nuttiness is that there is a BYU professor who wrote a paper about holy erections and how the 5 points of fellowship, if you get an erection with the other brother, that this is reminiscent of this erect phallus on God, the Eternal Father, that is Min, and that is a holy thing and that we should all embrace it. It's kind of been buried in the archives ever since they got rid of the 5 points of fellowship, but there was actually a professor who decided that this was worth a treatise of writing on, and that's pretty darn nutty.
What year was that?
70s again. It's the same time period where other people are editing this out. And in rebelliousness,
hang on, because now I want to find this article from the professor and I want to do a smackdown of it.
Seriously.
I will see if I can find it and send it to you guys so you can rejoice and revel in the
So did you use the phrase holy erection? I just want to understand. Is that what
it's calling that? An erection made sure.
This is what again, either we don't have the full story or everybody's doing it.
I
hope everyone's doing it.
This is a very believing little me that found and stumbled on this paper, and I read it with really wide eyes and had to go look up what the 5 points of fellowship were, and that's how I learned that was a thing.
Wow.
So anyway, wow. That is what I have as far as nutty Mormon history goes. Again,
that is nutty.
A couple of them. Every point comes from LDS sources.
Well, it was interesting. You know, there you were firing those off pretty quick to us, Kenneth, and you know, not a chance to discuss a lot of in between, but that's really interesting stuff. Really interesting.
So did you, in your story, did you like bring these up with your bishop or anything?
The story with my bishop, I went to him and I said, I was called to be a ward mission leader. And I said, I think I'd like to teach the 1832 version of the first vision rather than 1839, because I think it's closer to the source and would be historically more honest. And he didn't call me to the calling, and I had to get called into a review. So he was not quite ready for nutty Mormon history, because the first vision multiple copies were a little too much.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So no, I don't think there was no one to ask. This is one of my big complaints back all the way to when I was a faithful member. There is no answer guy in the ward, in the stake. There's no 70. There is no one you can go to and say, I have a question that is burning, that is deep within me, that I need some sort of answer. Like, you can go and say, I need to find my grandmother. There is a ward genealogy specialist, right? If you say, I need to know how to make jello with little carrot shavings, there is someone in the Relief Society called specifically for that. If you need to know how to move furniture, there is an elders quorum person with the calling to make sure that happens. But if you have a question about your own doctrine, there is no calling that you can turn to.
Well, you can go to your home teachers and they'll tell you to pray, and then you can pray and Heavenly Father will give you a good feeling and you don't have to worry about it anymore.
That is the solution.
What about the whole, that was then, this is now, not pertinent to your salvation, you know, stick with the basics. It just didn't cut it for you.
I mean, it did for a good long while. I started the research in 2007 when my father was dying of cancer. A lot of these questions or these answers just didn't do it anymore, as well as my daughter asking, like, I needed to have the real answers. And at some point, I'll tell you the point. I will tell you exactly the point. I was listening to Mormon Stories. Damn you, John DeLynn. And he had Michael Coe on. And I was raised by an amateur apologist. He really, really cared that we knew everything to know about Mesoamerica. So, you know, Mayan ball and how much they played it in the Olmecs versus the Mayans was something that you could just have a conversation with Dad, and Seer stones and all that. And so I knew a lot about Michael Coe because he was hauled along to validate all the Fair Mormon archaeological digs, because he was a non-Mormon. And John DeLynn's interviewing him, and he's like, so what do you believe on these things? Are they legitimate? And he's very direct, bless his heart, and says, like, well, they're two-faced. They do really good archaeology work out in the field, but they come home to you guys and spout all sorts of things they didn't go through back on the dig. Hmm. He said the famous words, there was no gold in Mesoamerica prior to the 700 AD. And I paused, and I hit the pause button, and I just was like in shock. I stopped. I didn't dare continue the episode for like 2.5 days. Then I started to just dig. I'm like, because I knew that there wasn't, and yet I'd always wanted there to be.
Well, but there was south of that.
There was in Peru.
In
right?
Lima, yeah. In Peru. And Lehi landed somewhere in Chile. So
in Chile.
As they were making their way up north, and you know, they came across the gold in Lima, Peru, and
the easy thing to say is that there's an absence of evidence, right? But the problem is there isn't. There's tons of evidence. You can see when the gold, they have this mountain range around the people who know how to work gold. And when it leaps over that mountain range, it spreads very quickly from one culture to the other. And they all start picking up the goldsmithing thing, so that by the time Cortez lands, there's tons of gold, and they melt all that down.
You know, the Michael Coe interview, the thing that got me the most from that was when he was saying, if this really is a record of these people from that time, why don't they talk about the value of chocolate beans? You know, why don't they talk, you know, and he started naming all of the things that there are evidence for in the archaeological record that there's no mention of at all in the Book of Mormon. And to me, that was more damning than any of the other things that it said that there are, that there aren't.
But not pertinent to your salvation.
Well, at that point,
Yeah, I mean, that. So I had reconciled that probably the LDS church wasn't true by that point, but I thought maybe it's the community of Christ or whatever. Sorry, I'm boring you. You're yawning.
No, I'm just tired. I've been up since 4.
But the and I looked into the FLDS and maybe I needed to join them, and I was like, you know, holding my nose and checking out all these different branches and the Apostolic Brethren and the Remnant Church and going through all these different versions. And then the Michael Coe interview, I'm like, well, there was no gold Cenines, there was no gold throne for King Noah. If that's not true, then it's just a metaphor, and it's not a very good one at that. And that was kind of it. So it became pertinent to my salvation at that point, because it cut off, you know, Strangites and Rickardonites and whatever you wanted to look at, Bickertonites.
I'm with you. I mean, it was the historicity of the Book of Mormon for me too. And then later I'm like, oh yeah, and sexism, racism, homophobia.
Right.
Too. But yeah, it starts with just not being what it purports to be in terms of its founding documentation and core tenets and beliefs and all that good stuff.
Yep. So there you go. Nutty Mormon history and a little bit of the history of how I got to it and started doing the digging. But it's possible for anyone to find these things, and more comes up every day. Johnny Stevenson just posted the Mormon Historians group about, you know, we all know the story because we were all missionaries, or a few were missionaries, I don't know, where you have to have the driver's license, right, to drive the car, and we hold it up, and we talk about priesthood authority with the third discussion. You youngins who did the Preach My Gospel probably didn't do the same thing, but similar anyway.
Didn't do that in Japan. We didn't have a driver's license. And
driver's license to hold up. Did you do the cups at least?
No.
The cups? No. Anyway, it turns out that there is no mention of the sealing power being given to Joseph until 1843. When Elijah shows up at the Kirtland Temple, he's just given him the genealogy stuff. There's nothing about sealings and marriages, and all of that comes, you know, years down the road. And so all of those plural marriages in that period of time, there was no, even according to the lore, there is no sealing power to legitimize them. They're just straight up adultery.
Yeah, priesthood is like a vortex inside of a pretzel inside of a black hole. Like the whole.
Well, but that's why, like, the church claims that DNC 132 was revealed to Joseph as early as 1832, going back to the Fanny Alger stuff, trying to justify all of that.
Yeah.
So they would retroactively challenge your 1843 thing and say, oh, well, actually, God revealed it to him in 1832. So it was around. We just didn't have any record of it.
He had the revelation, but no power, no keys, right? Because you don't have the Kirtland Temple till 1835, and it isn't given in the temple. In fact, we have one record in Nauvoo where Joseph claims that the sealing power was given to him in the Nauvoo Temple, which means that everything before that, even if he had, you, Joseph, shall go with an angel and a drawn sword and go have other men's wives, all of that was illegitimate until the sealing power would have been given. Long after Louisa Beeman, long after Fanny Alger, long after, like, it just, maybe Zina Huntington, Jacobs, Smith, Young, whatever, maybe. But that was just fascinating. It's one more nutty piece of history, cut out, ignored, that came up like yesterday.
And it's all just to test you. You researching the timelines of the priesthood revelations, I mean, that's just God making sure you're a true believer.
I failed the test, apparently.
Yeah, apparently. We all did.
All right. Well, thanks, Kenneth.
Glad to be here.
And thanks, Bob and John.
For sure. It was fun.
Thanks much.
All right. Take care.
Thanks, guys.
Scott became famous for freezing to death in Antarctica. Columbus made history thinking some island was in India. A national hero for not knowing when to run. All of these men are famous, and they're also very dumb.
History is made by stupid people. Clever people wouldn't even try.
If you want a place in the history books, then do something dumb before you die.
Hi, this is Nancy from Minneapolis, Minnesota, the great white north of the United States. You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com. And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. And if you act fast, you could put your review right next to mine, and we could be buddies. Anyone for the closing prayer?
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones. Infants on Thrones.